This is Aaron Kupferberg with PowerPopaholic.com. Today we will talk with Roger Joseph Manning Jr., the founder of the legendary power pop band, The Jellyfish. Today we're going to talk about Roger's latest album, Catnip Dynamite.
Aaron, thank you so much for being willing to call me as opposed to the blog route here. This is a lot easier and less time-consuming for me, and yeah. I get to be a little bit more detailed with my answers. So.
Right, and spontaneous. I appreciate that. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, it's great to talk with you. I know you've been pretty busy since those old Jellyfish days, so actually, I know you've worked on both Imperial Drag, Mood Cookbook, TV Eyes, and you've helped on countless other records on other musicians as a keyboardist, a vocalist, an arranger, a songwriter. Is there anyone you haven't played with yet that you wish you could, or anything, or an experience like that where you, wow, I wish I could play with this person or work with them?
Well, I have a lot of, heroes and people who are still up on a, pedestal for me, whether or not they need keyboard accompaniment or other people to assist them with their records is a different story. Everybody from Elvis Costello and Andy Partridge, kind of on the, veteran family there.
Okay.
But there's contemporary artists like, I like those DJs that are known as Justice, or there's that band called Midnight Juggernauts.
Right.
I mean, I think a lot of the more forward-thinking stuff is being done still for some reason in, like, the dance community. They seem to be pioneering ahead, and,
great.
There's so many, but that's a good start.
Okay. Well, another question. Do you feel that the legacy of Jellyfish is alive and well? Does this explain all the demand for your work and the demand of the work of your ex-bandmates as well?
The Jellyfish legacy is alive and well. I mean, it seems to be. I'm not out there every day on the blogs. I'm not out there in the chat rooms. But I know people continue to talk, and they can continue to have incredible respect for what we brought to the world in a very short time. And, yeah.
Great. Well, let's get to the new album. I want to talk about that. The themes in your new album, Catnip Dynamite, are varied and seems a little more darker than your previous album, Land of Pure Imagination. And I know many fans love that sweet, aching sadness in songs like I Wish It Would Rain and In the Name of Romance. That's kind of been, that really isn't so much present on the newer album as much as a more cynical approach, like Love's Never Half as Good. To me, it offers some of the best self-help advice I've heard in a while. Was there a conscious effort to make the content more sober and less romantic?
Nope. It just, it really ended up that way. I mean, a lot of just different things I was going through. It's no wonder that it kind of emerged in the lyric writing. As far as putting a collection of songs together, I basically look at my huge list of ideas and go, you know what, I really, really believe in that one. We haven't done it yet. Let's jump in on that one. And I'll tell you, all my song ideas, none of them have lyrics. Lyrics is one of the last things I do.
Huh, okay.
So it's not until I get to that lyric stage that you start getting the themes more and the attitudes. A song like Living in End Times, I had that song sitting around since the Imperial Drag days for the most part. And, again, with no lyric, and when I finally did finish the lyric, and then I came to decorate the song with keyboards and other arrangement embellishments, the lyric really dictated, like, a more dark, cinematic, ominous, foreboding doom kind of attitude.
Right. I mean,
I wasn't present in the original existence of the song. It was just kind of a straight-ahead rock and roll thing, It took on a specific character, and that's a good model for how all the songs unfold, really.
Okay. The single Down in Front is a pretty good description of the fall of American civility. Is this partially a reaction against the majority of the U.S. fan market in contrast with the Japanese fan market, who tend to be a little more, there's a little more adulation there, I think.
I suppose my gripes regarding American culture in general, having been privileged enough to have traveled briefly, and you get an immediate sense of what you are drawn to and you appreciate about other cultures and what repels you. And of course, you're always pitting it and comparing it against the culture you grew up in. And that song, yeah, it was kind of a venting, a griping about the people I find myself surrounded by, just, you know, going to the grocery store and walking by Starbucks or something. And then, yeah, conversely, having experienced Japanese culture, which is very, very different. But it's not a direct statement on that, but you're right. I mean, when I sit down to write lyrics, I literally have no freaking clue what I'm going to do. And I will, it's one of the longest things, most time-intensive parts of making my records. Catnip Dynamite took roughly an entire year to make.
Wow.
And keep in mind, most of the song ideas, melody, and chords, most of it was already written. It's not like I started from scratch. It took that long to flesh out the song, both with arrangement and lyric, and then record it by myself. I'm not happy it took this long. It just did.
Yeah, that's just the process.
Right. I wish it would have taken 5 or 6 months tops. So when I sit down to write the lyric, my point was, when I sit to write the lyric, it's like, you know, what's bubbling underneath me that day, and that's usually what comes spewing forth. I'll sing a lot of gibberish and made-up words when I sing like a rough into a cassette deck or something, so I don't get my idea.
Right.
Sometimes that gibberish, I'll string words together that don't make any sense, but they sound good phonetically. They have a musicality to them.
Right, they have a cadence that works. Yeah,
that is the word, exactly. And so sometimes I'll find I end up deciphering or translating or massaging that gibberish into, well, what if we just change these two words here? Oh, well, now what does that mean? Oh, well, it could mean this, like, you know, down in front. Obviously, I had to come up with a phrase, you know. And so that's the evolutionary process with that. And, I mean, how lucky am I that I got to work with I've worked with so many brilliant lyricist singers over the years, because they were always more excited to jump into the lyric than me. Mm-hmm. And since they were going to be singing it anyway, it was kind of their responsibility to create it.
Great. Well, another question I wanted to ask is, you know, over the years, a few bands newer bands have made efforts to sound like you a little bit, like Paul Steel, Big Kid, Brian Scary, and the Shredding Tears. Do you feel flattered? Do you kind of bristle from such fan-based comparisons to your style?
It's nothing but flattery. It blows my mind that my partners and I have touched in any way strangers that we don't know. They could be living here in Los Angeles or on the other side of the world, and it blows my mind. It is the biggest compliment ever. Now, look, you know, there's music I don't find gratifying and music I do. And unfortunately, there's a lot more music that I don't find very pleasing. And it comes in all genres, all styles.
Right.
And sometimes, I'll be real frank, there's a lot of pop bands, whether they're influenced by Jellyfish or not, or anything I've ever done or not, I just don't think have done their homework and really haven't. It's not that they haven't done their homework. I don't think they've learned to do something that I think all artists need to do. I don't care if you're a painter, sculptor, snowboarder, you know, singer, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That person has to learn to dig into their heart, into the depths of their emotion, whether they're doing dance music like Madonna or romantic pop like Elvis Costello or everything in between, because it's all about conveying emotion. And what I find is the tons of music that I hear, whether it's on the radio or somebody sends me a demo tape, hey, I want you to check out my band, you know, we're looking for a producer or whatever. These people haven't, for whatever reason, I don't live with them, they haven't learned to dig inside their soul and cry tears of pain, cry tears of joy into their art. And
that's what it means to be
emotional
artist.
Conveyance is something I've practiced and been very aware of as have my partners. I mean, Andy Sturmer was incredibly aware of this long before we hooked up to be a team. And I think that's one of the things we fed off of, and then as we united and created our gifts to the public, you know, a Jellyfish fan either gets it or they don't. There's no middle fans. There's no middle ground fans. They either hate us or they love every bit of what we do. And I think that comes from the intense passion, the intense emotional conviction that we conveyed.
Wow, great. Another thing that really impresses, I think, both fans and musicians alike is, you know, your production techniques. And one of the things that I was going to ask is, when you enter the studio with the job of putting together a final mix, do you have a pretty good idea of what you want, or do you just spend a lot of time tinkering to either, you know, try different combinations of sounds, like, or do you say, well, I'm not going to stop until this synth beat sounds like this Peter Gabriel song I heard a long time ago? I mean,
right. I mean, all of the above. I usually have some loose kind of notion in my head of where I'm headed, and I go for it. Now, along the way, I may run into several brick walls. And then you just, it's all a jigsaw puzzle. You just keep figuring things out, throwing ideas at it. If you don't know where you're headed, you can get into this great experimentation phase, which can yield some incredible results, but it's also insanely time-consuming. You know, I'll spend an entire week on not being able to get a chorus to bounce and feel good and be a celebration. And, like, you know, we get to the chorus, and I don't see the sun coming out.
Okay.
And if that doesn't, I mean, you don't stop until it happens, because inherent in what I try to do as a songwriter, whether I'm writing a guitar or a keyboard and just singing, right? I mean, I write in a very traditional way, just banging it out on an instrument and singing on top of it.
Right.
If it's not built in, if the chords and the feel and the way the melody sits on them don't convey, like, say you want the verse to be kind of medium skipping along, it's kind of sedate and just you're taking a walk, but then when the chorus comes in, you want it to really kick in, explode, you start running instead of walking, you know, the sun comes out, whatever silly cliche you want to use to describe it verbally, if you don't hear that as the listener from somebody just playing the piano and singing, or playing the guitar and singing, then once again, that is a sign to me of weak songwriting, or of songwriting that is incomplete. It could have gone so much further.
Right.
Okay. So that's crucial to me. As I'm throwing all kinds of ideas into the cassette deck as my scratch pad, when I listen back in my car a week later, or a year later, or in some cases 15 years later, if those ideas don't do that for me and go, because at that point, the arrangement just starts taking care of itself. It's connect the dots. You just
right.
color in the lines. You already have the drawing. You just go, oh, we're going to make this guy's shirt red, his hair is going to be blonde, his eyes are going to be blue. You know, that just starts taking care of itself. So in other words, you don't save the song. You don't save a mediocre song through throwing instruments on it. You know, the phrase that goes around sometimes is, you can't polish a turd.
That's true. That's true.
And I can't tell you how many times I get called, bless these people's hearts, when I do session work. Mm. You want me to come in and with my keyboard magic somehow save a very mediocre song that doesn't have a chorus that we all want to sing. It doesn't have a groove that makes you want to move your body.
Right.
And they're expecting me and the other outside musicians to come in and work some magic. It ain't going to happen, pal.
Yeah, it's only so much you can do
right.
with that, you know.
And I'm not complaining. I love playing on people's records. You know, write it in your interview. Bands who have small budgets, medium budgets, they can always email me, call me. Hey, Roger, we want you to sing on one song. We want you to play on two songs. We scrounged up a couple bucks. Will this work for you? Usually I can do it in an afternoon here from my home. I love playing on people's records. I don't care if you're a celebrity or just starting out.
Great.
I've already done that with some fans over the past 2 years, and it's been very cool.
Excellent. So, to the album Catnip Dynamite, are you going to be touring to support the album at all, or?
No. for several reasons. One is mostly just financial. I have to pay three side musicians to help me. Mm-hmm. The guys that I have used over the years are just, they're phenomenal. They all sing background vocals, and they're talented working musicians here in Los Angeles. And just as I would want to be paid, I want to respect them and pay them properly. And there's no budget for that. No record company, including some of the majors now, have proper touring budgets. I'm not going to sleep in the back of a van. I'm not going to sleep on friends' houses across the country. I'm not going to eat at McDonald's.
that makes sense.
Yeah, if there's not a proper touring budget, it's pointless. Part two is that just like performing Jellyfish music, performing my music is no easy task. It's very grueling, which means all the musicians on stage are basically, we turn into a juggling act. We're all doing 10 things at once. We're all sweating. And it's really, really hard. And it takes its toll on you night after night. And although it's a rush and it's fun to perform that for your friends, it's just, it's so grueling.
Hmm.
So imagine I come home after 6 weeks. Not only have I, if I've managed to scrounge up enough money to pay all my guys.
You want 6 months to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no I've made no money, so I can't pay my rent and bills like everybody else has to. So it's just like, again, unless there's some kind of infrastructure or the album is just selling amazingly, and so there's like reason to get a loan and invest in a touring thing. You know, we've got like a radio play or something, or a single is getting some attention off a TV show. That would change everything. But right. For me and your average artist out there on an indie label, that stuff happens, but it's just fewer and far between, that's all.
Okay.
I'm sorry to sound pessimistic, but I want people to understand why I'm not, you know, in the back of a van jet-setting across the country to come to your town and spread the pop goodness. I would love to do that. It's just not. The logistics are a nightmare. Unless somebody can show me different, that's how it's been so far.
Okay. Well, speaking of the road and everything, is there anything in your past, interesting stories from the road that you'd want to share, like most embarrassing moment or something really cool that blew you away as a performer that happened?
Wow. I mean, my God, everything from my own shows to just being out with Beck. I mean, the Beck tour alone every other night was some crazy tale to write home about. Okay, well, the one that comes to mind, and you can print this if you want.
Okay.
It's kind of harsh. It's kind of abrasive. But it's terribly amusing.
Go right ahead.
I was in Beck's band, and we were in Scotland, and we were playing a theater. I'm going to say about 3,500 people a show.
Mm-hmm.
Great crowd. Show started off like any other. Towards the end of the show, especially with the encore, Beck really breaks out into a lot of his more hyper hip-hop dance number type songs, you know, the real party tracks.
Right.
And he was noticing that this crowd, although they were good, they just, nobody was standing up, nobody was dancing, nobody was kind of getting into that part of it. So he starts egging on the crowd, encouraging them, come on, everybody get up, what's your excuse? And when he starts doing that, some of the guys in the band get on the mic too and try to help him, like, you know, get the crowd to party. So Beck did something unusual this night, which he usually doesn't do, which is he jumped off the stage, which is fairly low, and, you know, he went right out into the crowd with his microphone and was, like, dancing with girls and picking guys up and, you know, get out of your seat, let's go. And in general, it was really well received. It was great. Really started to get the crowd to partake in everything. He gets this one section of the audience up front. And they just wouldn't stand up. But it was like they were like a gang of kids. And they would not have anything to do with this. And so some of the guys on the stage like rushed off the stage and like started screaming at them like, come on, what's wrong with you guys? Let's party! You know, just getting into the spirit, right?
Right.
They didn't stand up. And we're like, what the fuck? So we had a great show, finished it off. We were all backstage. And although we had a great show, all we could talk about was what was with those idiots in the front there, those jerks who thought they were all tough and like, oh, we're too good to stand up and party with all of you. So after the show, we were all eating dinner and catering, and and we're kind of finishing up, hanging out, talking, getting ready to get back on the bus and take off. One of the road crew guys comes back to talk to us to let us know, oh my God, get ready for this, to let us know that he knew that we were frustrated by some of the people in the crowd tonight, and that we all might want to know that that section of the theater was reserved for the handicapped.
Oh.
And the reason we didn't see their wheelchairs is because they'd been escorted out of their wheelchairs into their seats. None of them could stand up, even if they wanted to. And there were about 15 to 20 kids there.
Oh, my goodness.
And we almost all threw up. Because we were just like, we got totally sick, like, oh my God, we were like yelling at these people, like, you know, what's wrong with you, what's wrong, because we had no clue.
That's okay.
There wasn't any, like, you know, reserved for.
Last I heard, Joseph Biden did the same thing on
the
campaign, yes, told a veteran, stand up and, you know, raise your hand to the crowd, and the guy was in the wheelchair.
Right. And so you can imagine for the next 2 weeks on tour, we would see each other, and everybody on stage experienced this. And so we'd see each other, and we'd go, is that, like, the most absurd tragedy, you know, we've ever experienced, or is it, like, the funniest thing in the world? Because nobody knew. All of us were innocent.
I found it strange that no one told you during the whole thing.
I know. Well, you know, yeah, nobody could run out on stage and be like, don't yell at them, you know, they're crippled. I mean, it's like, that wasn't going to happen. Anyway, I will never forget that one. And so if you want to print that, be my guest, but obviously be very tactful about it.
Sure, sure. Well, just to finish off, what's next for Roger Manning Jr.?
I'm doing all kinds of things to stay creatively fulfilled. The last 10 years since I deliberately kind of got off the road, it was very hard to make music on the road. I mean, I have toured with some of the funnest people, some of the greatest musicians, and especially the Beck family was just amazing. But there's no time. You're so busy traveling. It's like being in the military or something. There's no time to get creative. I tried to do a remix from the road once. It was a remix that should have taken me 3.5-4 days.
Right.
It took me 3 weeks. Oh. I was on tour with a laptop and some of my accessories, very minimal stuff I could shove in my suitcase. Because you get started on it for 2 hours here, and then you'd be able to work on it overnight here when you couldn't sleep, and then maybe a day here. Then you wouldn't be able to touch it for 4 days. And then you'd have to come back and remember what you did and what was your idea and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? Enough of this. I'm in my early 30s. Yes, I've made some records, but nowhere near as much as I want to. So I want to stay home. I want to make records. I don't care if they're my own or other people's. And started exploring all kinds of projects. I did a lot of remixes for a while, but that's died down. A lot of companies don't have the budget for promo remixes anymore. They're done very specialty, done on very rare occasions now. I've done some work for commercials and like background spots for everything from like Comedy Central and VH1 to, you know, commercials like for Verizon or Best Buy or stuff like that. And those are through music house agencies that work with the ad agencies.
Right.
And that has been something I was not interested in doing, and I've actually started to enjoy it because I got better at it. I'm continuing to learn something every time. And I'm asked to do all kinds of styles of music from orchestral to full-on hip-hop, and this is not something I study or practice every day. So every job is kind of like taking a class in college.
Right, so continually learn.
Right. And unlike a big movie, which you're going to be on for 4 months or something, or a TV show with you know, crazy time deadlines, a lot of these smaller projects, they're in and out in a few days. And you don't always necessarily get them, because sometimes you'll be bidding against other people for the job, and the client then decides which flavor they like the best.
Right.
So, and so, you know, and there's demo fees, but it's not much. But if you just get enough of them going, they can pay out, and it's you know, it's better than sitting at home going, okay, when's the next guy going to call for me to play on his record?
Right.
Because it's always changing. Everybody will call me like 1 month. You know, three guys will call me 1 month, and then I don't hear from anybody for 2 months, just because of the ebb and flow, the nature of the business.
Right. That's the nature of the freelancer.
Exactly. So I have to continually juggle and plan 5-6 months ahead. There's all kinds of projects. I'm in the middle of writing. I'm working on the new Glen Campbell album. He just put one out, but we've already started the next one.
Wow.
And I've been told, I've officially been hired, it hasn't happened yet, to write the segue music in between the songs. I'm going to compose little 20, 30, 40 second transitions that link the songs together.
Oh, okay.
So that's very exciting.
Cool.
Then in March, I am actually going to do some shows, very brief shows, in Taipei, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, China, with Taiwanese artist named Joanna Wang.
Oh.
And I wrote some songs with her for her upcoming record, being released in February, I believe. So all kinds of stuff rolling in and out. I'm just trying to stay creative and just keep my eyes open for the next fun project that I can sink my teeth into and be of use for. You know?
Well, yeah. Well, the fans will definitely keep their ears open for your next project. After this one has been fully digested by the public,
mm-hmm.
and I really appreciate you calling and talking with me and everything. This is Aaron Kupferberg for Power Popaholic. Thanks very much, Roger. I appreciate the interview.
Aaron, thank you again for calling me. I know my answers can be very long-winded, and you have to transcribe them. So I'm sensitive to that, but...
It's not a problem. It's on the blog. It's not on a major network or anything.
Got it. Well, thank you again, and I appreciate your support, and spread the good news. I know you do.
All right. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.